and welcome to Ask the Mayor here on WBAA News. I'm your host, Emily Seiberg. This week, we're talking with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. Thanks so much for being with us, as always. As you're listening, remember you can always email your questions for the mayor today and for any of our mayors to ask, that is ASK, at WBAA.org. Good afternoon, Mayor.
Good afternoon, Emily.
And how are you today?
I'm fine, thank you.
So we talked about this a little bit before the show got going, but of course, big news this week, substantial changes to the state's COVID-19 plan going forward. Vaccinations open up to Hoosiers 16 years of age and older on March 31st. That's next Wednesday. And COVID restrictions will be rolled back. The mask mandate becomes an advisory on April 6th, though one of the things this plan does stipulate is that local governments and private businesses can put more restrictive requirements in place. So I guess, first of all, what's your reaction specifically to the lifting of restrictions and the mask mandate? Is it time to do that? Is it time to lift those restrictions?
Yeah, I didn't find that terribly surprising for a couple of reasons. One, the governor's been pretty clear that if we saw improvement for, you know, a couple of weeks, you know, at a time the data was strong, that he would consider that. So I think that was it kind of expected from most of us. The other thing is, I think, you know, you just have to be real and look at the timing and understand that the legislature is nearing the end of its session. And, you know, there's a lot of talk, a lot of bills about changing the governor's powers there. So I think that timing played in as well. I think there's clearly an effort to say, look, you know, I'm going to be reasonable to those who think I'm being too overburdensome. So I wasn't surprised by really any of that at this point.
So do you think there is any possibility that Crawfordsville or Montgomery County would, you know, elect to maintain some restrictions? You know, for example, I believe masks are going to be required in state government buildings. Would masks be required in city government buildings?
Well, our plan right now is really just to look at the data and make data-driven decisions. And as the data stands right now, no, it's not going to be required. But if we see a shift in that data, and we'll be in constant consultation with the health officer, and if we see things changing there, then we'll consider what actions we need to take. But as of right now, the way that the data is looking, we think we're, you know, in pretty good shape on that side. That doesn't mean we can let our guard down all the way around. And if you look at the data, Montgomery County has been a little bit of an anomaly in that we've been improving, but not at the same rate as some of the others. And I've heard Dr. Douglas just say today that he's kind of concerned that maybe we've plateaued out and we're not going to see go to the next level, you know, go to that blue level, if you will. So those are things we have to take into consideration. But, you know, for me, in the end, it has to be data driven. That's what has to happen. And as I've said many, many times throughout this, if that happens here locally through executive order, it will be a short term thing. Anything long term, I feel absolutely very strongly needs to go through the legislative branch of government.
So what are some other things you're now thinking about and discussing possibly with other local officials in the days to come about what else will look different on April 6th in Crawfordsville?
Well, I think, you know, right now we're just early in those conversations, and I don't know that things are going to look vastly different because, you know, the schools are still going to be pretty much under the same restrictions, and they need to be so we can wrap up the school year safely. There is talk about events and event sizes and how we're going to handle some of that. But I think the sense that I'm getting is that we are all kind of on the same page, that we'll just continue to follow the metrics that have been laid out by the government with that color-coded system. So as we know where we're at with the data, and then we can adjust accordingly with event size and so on.
So how do you think the lifting of the mask mandate specifically, and again, that's now an advisory. I know that that can kind of be a semantics game at times, hard to figure out. But
right.
How will that, you know, play out in Crawfordsville among residents? Do you think that people will overnight have a shift in their mask wearing behavior? Do you think people will stick with what they've been doing out of habit? What do you foresee happening?
Well, I think that's going to largely be driven by private business. You know, if the retailers all continue to require it within their stores, then I don't think you're going to see really a big change. If they all, if the big box and everybody else says, okay, this has gone away, then I think you'll see a big shift. But otherwise, as far as people just out in general in the public, most of them are outdoors doing things and not wearing masks, because they may be 100 feet from other people. So that will largely be driven by the private sector. And if you think back, that's how it was driven before the state mandate. It was the larger companies, the grocers and the big box, who came along and said, this is going to be required in our store. That's the most impact. And I think that's what you'll see in reverse as we kind of exit out of this.
It does feel like we're having in reverse some of the conversations that we were having last summer. And the door's been left open in case things start trending back in the wrong direction. The public health emergency order will be in place through the end of April. And that also allows the state to access federal funding. If there's a U-turn, if things start going back in the wrong direction, I guess how are people going to take that if we have to go back?
That'll be tough. And I think if we do go backwards and we have to, ramp up some of these restrictions again, I think you absolutely have to couple that with a solid explanation and solid data. They feel like the goalpost has been moved several times, and I think you have to be very careful and very aware of that. And you're going to have to be absolutely upfront and transparent with the public. But there are a lot of things playing in our favor right now, so I'm optimistic because you have more and more people vaccinated. Of course, you have people that have immunity because they had the actual virus, and the weather is in our favor. I mean, we're reaching that time of year. If you think back to last year, once people are outside and not, crammed together in buildings, that just really plays in our favor. So all that coming together leaves me with a great deal of optimism. But, I've said all along, we're not going to just see, these trends where we just continue to improve without, there's going to be some setbacks here and there. We know that. There's a little apprehension right now about spring break. What does that mean as families and people travel around the country, go to other areas, they fly, they do those kinds of things. Will we see a spike? There's a concern about that. But on the other hand, we've been concerned about other holidays and things. And sometimes that happened and sometimes it didn't. So we'll have to see.
I remember us talking about fall break, actually last fall specifically,
right.
and kind of talking
right.
about how that was I think you said it at the time that it's kind of different than it used to be. It's a longer,
a longer
break, more travel involved. And certainly, up here, we've been hearing that from some health professionals, that concern about spring break. If a family's going to Florida, for example, where the variant is a little more widespread coming back from that. Those are all things on health professionals' minds right now.
And I think people are more apt to travel right now at spring break than they were last fall. People are, they're a little more comfortable. Maybe they've been vaccinated, those kinds of things. So it'll be interesting to see how that, what that impact is.
You are listening to Ask the Mayor on WBAA News. I'm your host, Emily Seiberg. Right now, we're talking with Crawfordsville Mayor Todd Barton. So let's talk a little bit about vaccinations. When you and I spoke in February, the state had just opened up vaccinations to 60 to 64-year-olds. Now, a month later, again, next week, we're opening up to 16 and older. So the
Big
state
change.
Is opening up to millions of people all at once, when so far it's been more measured and incremental. And to kind of put a number on this, our Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter said the amount of vaccine doses Indiana will get next week is expected to increase by about 38%, and there will be about 420% more Hoosiers eligible to get their shot. So what kind of challenges does that kind of expansion present?
Well, I think it's important to keep in mind, first and foremost, that, this has come down from the federal level. There's been a very clear direction from the federal level that you need to open this up to all adults, and they've set some very clear target dates. So that's kind of what's happening there. But we're bracing for that. But I'm not overly concerned because I think there's a direct relationship. As you lower the age threshold, there are more and more people eligible. That's obvious. But I think of the percent of the people who are eligible, there's a smaller percentage who want the vaccine. And that's just normal. I mean, young people are invincible, right? So fewer and fewer young people fewer people in the 20 age range want it percentage-wise than people in the 70 age range. They just don't see themselves as being at risk. So I think the impact's not going to be as severe as some people are concerned, but certainly we're going to have, you know, it's going to push out that wait time. It's going to push out appointment times. That's why it's so important that we have every avenue possible. And I've been kind of harping on that for a while. So all of the pharmacies, the health department, you know, our program with our community paramedics, we have to explore every avenue possible to be getting vaccine to people and opening up as many time slots as possible.
We have talked about some of the innovative ways that vaccines could be administered in your area. And I saw it looks like the Crawfordsville Fire Department is now vaccinating homebound residents.
They are.
Can you tell us more about that?
So in partnership with the health department had received an allotment of Johnson & Johnson, which is a single dose. And then through various mechanisms have identified people in the community who are, for lack of a better term, you know, homebound. You know, they can't necessarily easily get to the vaccine site. And in some cases, they're afraid, they're frightened. They don't want to go to the vaccine site. They've been locked down for months and they don't want to expose themselves. So we send our community paramedics in, and the process is identical to what happens in the vaccine site. There's a question process. There's a screening process. Vaccines administered. There's an observation period. And the other thing they found is it takes a little bit longer in the home because people, they want to talk, you know, they've been stuck at home for a while. So you kind of have to build that into the schedule. So it's a little bit of a slower process, but, we are reaching a lot of people and the stories that I hear out of that are very touching. People are so thankful that opportunity exists in our community and that somebody will bring a vaccine to them and safely administer it to them. So the community paramedics are working on that in conjunction with the health department. And then, of course, our community paramedics, you know, are a driving force behind creating the first vaccine clinic specifically for teachers.
I saw
on the
that.
Day that it opened up. Mm-hmm. So Crawfordsville was number one vaccine clinic just for, not, I shouldn't say teachers, but school employees. So it's a wider range, you know, everybody who works in a school. On that day, each corporation sent 10 people, and then a few days later, we opened it up and did several hundred.
So what are the best ways for other communities to learn to use these types of models? You know, how hard is it to pull this off?
Well, I'll tell you the absolute driving thing, number one, is everybody, is cooperation. Everybody has to play nicely together, and I say this all the time when we talk to other communities. You know, check your ego at the door. You know, you have to learn to work well with everyone else. So that means the hospital, the city, the county, the health department, every schools, everybody has to be willing to compromise and work together. That's number one. And number two is, you know, just ask and learn from other communities. We've done a lot of that, and we are fortunate to be able to help other communities now. You know, reach out to the State Department of Health. They understand this process. They're a strong partner of ours. Don't be afraid to reach out to our people. We will tell you what works and where we've run into issues and how to set it up and how to make it happen.
Given the amount of people, again, coming on board next week, do you think these types of, you know, more mobile, more flexible vaccination processes might need to be used more broadly to reach as many people as possible?
We think so, and we're exploring that right now. You know, the ultimate factor there is supply. You know, how much vaccine do you have? So if we get the supplies we're hoping for, we fully intend to carry out what we call pods, where we take the vaccine to people. You know, if we don't, then we'll have to scale that back. But our concern right now is, you know, we kind of saw this coming. I mean, volunteers have been critical to what's happening here. The vaccine site that the health department's operating on South Boulevard has been phenomenally successful. It's highly efficient. It's very professional. It gets rave reviews from everybody. It is very volunteer dependent. And I said, we're going into this. That's great for a while, but these people are going to get tired. And we're reaching that point. You know, when you volunteer every Saturday and you work 5 days a week, you start to get a little tired after a while. And the health officer identified that in our briefing this morning, that we need to be thinking, you know, a little bit more long-term, especially on the medical professional side, the people who are actually administering the vaccine. We need to start bolstering our resources and finding more volunteers, because we're wearing our volunteers out. So that's kind of the next step for us, is really thinking about that.
Can you talk about, to the extent that you're able, how the health officer in Montgomery County is feeling about some of the things we talked about at the top of the show, the repeal of restrictions and, you know, the mask mandate? Did that come up this morning?
Well, if I speak for him, I might get in trouble. But I think my sense is that, you know, he's always a little guarded with this. So, you know, he was very quick to point out that, yes, the data is good, but Montgomery County has not progressed as quickly as other areas, even our surrounding counties. I think everything to our west is blue. You know, so again, those are smaller populations, a little easier to manage. But, you know, he's optimistic, don't get me wrong, but he's also very realistic in his approach and pointing out where the dangers continue to lie.
So the conversations that we have been having with health professionals over the past day or so have basically, their question has been, again, why are we removing safeguards when most people aren't vaccinated yet and will not possibly be for some time as they're waiting for their appointments? We've made, you know, a great deal of progress. We have three different vaccines. That's all good. But we haven't gotten those into many arms yet. You know, that's coming. You know, we're hearing concerns about the gap, kind of racing to get as many people vaccinated as possible. You know, and why not keep some of this stuff in place just a bit longer to give vaccine providers a little more time to get as many people vaccinated as possible?
Well, you're always going to have that debate when, you know, when is the timing right about removing things? And it's a tough call. I have no doubt about that. You know, I suspect that, you know, again, they've been saying data-driven, and the data right now does not support a lot of the things that are in place. And you know, I know some people don't want to hear that, but that's just a fact that data doesn't support it. So if we're going to be data driven, you're going to have to do that both ways. Now, everyone will be quick to point out if they make those changes and the data worsens, then obviously, you know, those measures were working and they're going to have to reinstitute some of them. So it's data driven. But like I said at the beginning of the show, I do think what's happening in the legislature, nobody will say that, but I think that plays a factor in this as well.
A big question I'm putting to the mayors on the show this month is, what are your plans? What's your thought process about the federal aid headed for state and local governments as part of the big relief package passed about 2 weeks ago? What conversations are you having right now?
Well, so we are concentrating on those first initial steps, which is how you create the accounts and put the money in there and then kind of go from there. I participated in a webinar with communities all over the country yesterday to try to understand this better. And I will tell you, when it was over, I was probably more confused than when it started. So the reality there is we just don't know. And, you know, if anybody's telling you that they have this plan all laid out, they know where they're headed, they're probably going to change their plan because there are so many unknowns there. It's not like you're going to get a check and you just say, okay, we'll just do all these things. CARES Act kind of ended up that way, but I don't think this is going to be that way. And there's different pots of money. Mm-hmm. So that's important to understand. There is an allotment to communities, but there's also all these other pots for public health and infrastructure and so on. It is a very complex act. I will say that. And the professionals conducting the webinar yesterday were kind of confused. So that tells me my reaction was, if somebody could figure this out and become a consultant, they would be very, very busy right now. So the overarching message right there was, don't act in haste. You're going to need some time, and you have some time. You have a few years. You're mm-hmm. going to need some time to figure this out and really figure out how you utilize these resources to have the most impact in your community. And every community is going to look at that differently, but, you know, it's going to take some time. It really is going to take some time to sort it out.
So just today, thinking about it, you know, if you had to say where monies could be best spent in Crawfordsville, if you had to take a stab at it, what would you say?
Well, it's interesting. If you look at that act, it focuses very heavily on public health. And we're doing some innovative things here with our community paramedics and mobile integrated health. So that, to me, stands out. I mean, that's a huge glaring use right there. we could really do some work to take what we're doing to the next level. So that, I think, is definitely on the table. There's, you know, talk of infrastructure work. We have some infrastructure needs right now that we are working to address. So that could become a part of this as well. And then I think we're going to have to really have a community conversation about where we go from there. We know what our priorities are. We know what our weaknesses are. We know what we need to address. The question is going to be, can this funding be used to help us, you know, address some of those needs?
Were you relieved? Were you glad to see that this money was headed for state and local governments when it came through?
Yeah, to an extent. I'll tell you, I'm a little guarded because my understanding when it first passed was that this was going to flow directly from the federal government to the locals. And I applauded that. And then I found out that it's actually going to come through states. So that makes me a little cautious. Now, apparently they put a parameter. They have 30 days to pass it to locals. You know, and again, I'm playing back to the CARES Act in which, you know, states kind of bogged that process down and tried to create their own requirements. And that's probably my biggest concern with this. If you look at those pots of money for infrastructure and public health and so on, it looks to me like those are going to be administered through the states. That just adds another level, many levels of bureaucracy and slows the process down. So I'm hopeful that doesn't happen, but I'm a little wary of it.
The city of Crawfordsville and the Mayor's Special Commission on Racial Equality are partnering with, this is a long intro, the Wabash Democracy and Public Discourse Initiative to hold a community conversation next month.
We are.
So first off, let's get a general update on the Special Commission, which you formed last summer. What progress has been made? Where are things at on that to-do list?
So they, you know, they started meeting last summer and made a tremendous amount of progress. I was very pleased. And as I've said all along, it's a group of people who want to really get in there and roll up their sleeves and get to work and make things happen. Then we hit a period of time there where not much happened because we had the holidays and COVID had really ramped up. So we kind of had to back off the meetings. And now they're eager, they're ready to go. So they started meeting again. And, you know, if you look at that plan I laid out, there were all these different actions I was going to take. We've done a lot of those, but we're down to the ones that involve public conversations and public input and things like that. And that, of course, has been difficult because of the pandemic. So we're now reaching the point that we have a comfort level that we can start to pull some of that together. We're probably pushing the timeline a little bit from the pandemic standpoint, but we're doing that because we know the students who are facilitating this conversation are on a ticking clock here, right? So, mm-hmm. You know, come May, we lose them. They're gone. So we have to make things happen a little quicker than what we probably would do otherwise. But if you know much about Wabash Democracy and Public Discourse Program, it is very powerful. It really teaches these students how to facilitate community conversations about challenging issues. And I've been to many of those conversations and everybody comes in kind of amped up and ready for a fight. And everybody leaves saying, hey, this was pretty good. This was good conversation, you know? So I'm excited that we're going to have that on this important topic in our community.
So tell us a little bit more about this April event. You know, what are the aims? What's the setup?
Well, so they'll start out with a panel discussion, and I'm not sure exactly who's going to be on that panel yet. The Wabash folks are working through that, but they'll talk about different experiences in our community from different perspectives. And then you break into small groups where you have several people at a table, typically with differing opinions, and you'll have one, what we call fellow, who's trained to kind of facilitate and guide that conversation. And what I've experienced in the past is that people, you know, they may not admit it, but they learn something from listening to other people, and they'll walk out of there with that because they'll hear about their perspective or their experience and they'll find that it's a different view. But they also feel like they've had a chance to say their piece and get whatever they had to say off their mind and then somebody else heard them. So that's really all that happens. And then all of the points from those conversation are kind of captured and then encapsulated at the end with a report to the community and to the commission and myself and so on. And then we kind of try to start to flesh out some next steps from there. What needs to happen to address some of the things that were brought up and pointed out?
So do you anticipate, and again, this is with the hope that COVID will continue to become less of an issue for gatherings and group settings, you know, more events like this, more discussions?
Oh, definitely. You know, so there's this event. And then over the summer, we plan to have several events where the community and police interact and get to know one another a little bit better, and kind of, you know, just build that relationship. We're optimistic we'll be able to have those. And then my guess is that, you know, when Wabash returns in the fall, we'll probably follow up with another conversation at that point.
I actually, speaking of the police department, a quick note. I saw the Board of Works approved a grant agreement for upgrades to police department body cameras. So I just wanted to ask what kind of upgrades that was going to address.
Well, we were one of the early departments in the state to equip our officers with body cameras. And like anything involving technology, they have a lifespan, and we're nearing the end of that lifespan. So the technology has changed tremendously since we acquired ours. And we're just going with we'd applied for a grant to basically upgrade several units, but we're committing ourselves to just upgrading every unit that we have on every officer. And we're going with a system that has newer technology that's stored in the cloud. You know, it's a little more automated, so you reduce that human error factor of, a dramatic moment and they forgot to activate it. It activates on its own in certain situations. And the system we're looking at is, and I think this is important, is the only system to be accredited and endorsed by the NAACP. And I think that's important because, you know, it gives people that assurance that it's been vetted by an independent source, and it's a good system. So, we're moving forward with that.
Okay. Also, looks like the city and the county are working on an agreement as to who's in charge of maintaining what road. I know this is something a lot of places deal with. What's the system now? How does that work now?
Well, it's been kind of chaotic. So that agreement, we've been working on that for a long time, and it's finalized and done. But you have these roads or these streets that are on the periphery of the city. So maybe one side is in the city and one side is not. And under the old annexation laws, the city and the county split that down the middle.
So a road would be split?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So, okay.
So it's half city, half county.
Okay.
We've always worked well at sorting that out here, but it becomes confusing. Now, the newer areas that we've annexed, the city has responsibility for the entire road in front of that, but that did used to be the case. So, you know, you run into issues. It's time to repave it, time to rework it. You know, we split the cost in half. We've had issues in it butts up against a residential area, and so we want to pass a speed limit. Does that just apply to one side and not to the other side?
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, so all kinds of things like that come out. And so we just worked out this agreement where, you know, certain roads will take the entire road, and certain sections of the county will take the entire road. We think that's a good, fair, equitable way to do it, and it will really streamline the process for everybody involved.
That's our time for today. Mayor Barton, thanks for being with
us. Thank you.
You can find this program at our website, WBAA.org, along with an archive of our shows with the mayors of Lafayette, West Lafayette, Crawfordsville, and Frankfort. Send us your questions to ask@WBAA.org. Thanks for listening, and have a great rest of the day.